Hello, and welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. Human stories are practically always about one thing, really. Death. The inevitability of death. There is no such thing as a natural death. Nothing that ever happens to man is natural, since his presence calls the whole world into question. All men must die, but for every man, his death is an accident, and even if he knows it, he would sense to it an unjustifiable violation. J.R.R. Tolkien in an interview with the BBC, 1968. Death is the best-kept secret of modern society. Marketing researchers say we see thousands of images of advertisements a day. From these thousands of images, we are promised good skin, good teeth, a full bank account, a one-of-a-kind style, attractiveness, a healthy body, adventure, experience, satisfied taste buds, and everything that screams abundant and eternal life. In all those thousands of pictures, very few, if any, will nod to the inevitable truth. You will die. Everyone in history so far has died. Your pet will die. Your family members will die. Your enemies will die. Your friends will die. All these shiny ads seem to conveniently dance around the inconvenient fact, and yet their most powerful appeals gesture to that deepest fear, that through whatever they offer, whether it's wealth or health or beauty, we might be able to live forever. Death is an irreducible mystery. It is strange and unimaginable. There's nothing we can particularly say to make it seem less obtuse, more manageable, or more sensible. As Tolkien said in the quote at the beginning, no man's death seems natural, though it is one of the most established facts in all the world. Some philosophies have tried to say that life is an illusion, and so death too is an illusion. But in our experience, this seems very silly. Death seems like an impossibly tall brick wall that at some point everyone is able to leap suddenly over, leaving us behind, unable to see where they went or guess what it might be like. So what are we to make of death? The thing to do with mysteries is not to solve them, but to learn how to regard them, how to approach them, and how not to be afraid. And since wallowing in a soup of existential dread seems, if nothing else, impractical for our everyday lives, we must learn how to reckon with death. If we cannot solve the problem of death, we must learn how to live in light of it, how to remember that our actions in this world will have a meaning, but they will also have an end, that they are fleeting and that our time is limited. And if at all possible, we must learn to live in such a way that prepares us for, if there is such a thing, a good death. This is what Lent is all about. Lent is the season of reckoning with our mortality, our frailty, our inability to do good. I think that all of us are aware of this at some point in ourselves. We see it on the news, we experience it in our own lives, we know that it's true somewhere in the pit of our stomachs, that there's something broken in the world. We see the beauty and the barrenness and the brokenness, and we rarely speak about it except in whispers. We are not sure how to make sense of it. What a relief it is, then, to have a whole season dedicated to saying, yes, darkness, death, evil, these things are realities that affect us. So what in the world are we to do with them? I remember the first time I went to an Ash Wednesday service. It really impacted me. It was at this little church in California, and it was this odd mixture of a California beachy place and a cathedral, and all the light was streaming in as the sun was setting. And all of us went forward, every single one of us, the old and the young, the little kids, people who belonged there and knew each other, people who were strangers. They all went forward and they marked us with the sign of the cross with the ashes on our forehead. And they said, from dust you came and to dust you will return. Now I'm sure that sounds pretty depressing, but to me there was something of a relief in just having someone say it out loud, reckoning with it together and trying to make sense of it. We can't think our way around the problem of death, so I think it's the best to feel our way around it. And there is no better guide in this endeavor than art. For as Tolkien said, most stories and paintings and songs are doing their best to make sense of death. So today, I want to begin a series of podcasts investigating the themes of Lent, beginning with death in honor of Ash Wednesday tomorrow. This week, we will investigate the question of how can we live a life in preparation for a good death? We'll explore this question through the Eisenheim Altarpiece by Matthias Grunewald, a brutal image painted to comfort and hearten those suffering from plague in the 16th century Europe, and to guide them in the Ars Moriendi, the art of death. Then my brother Joel Clarkson will guide us through Edward Elgar's unstaged opera based in the poem of Cardinal John Henry Newman, The Dream of Gerontius. This piece reimagines a traditional religious literary structure, the morality play, through the lens of Romanticism, following the journey of one man as he faces death. And finally, we'll look at the stubbornly hopeful sonnet, Death Be Not Proud, by John Donne. I picked these pieces because they bravely stare death in the face, but comfort their audiences that though we must all die, we do not die alone. And so let's dive into this week's rather cheerful episode of Speaking with Joy, based on the Lenten theme of death. But before we dive into that, I wanted to issue a few reminders for all of my regular listeners. First of all, I wanted to remind you all that I'm doing a Scottish giveaway. So I'll be giving away a special care package full of Scottish gifts, which you can enter to win by rating and reviewing this podcast on iTunes, sharing it somewhere on social media, or sharing it with a friend, and then sending me an email at thejoinusthebrave@gmail.com. And secondly, I just wanted to remind you that even if you don't want to enter the giveaway, to please rate and review this podcast if you enjoy it, because that really helps get the word out. So without further ado, let's dive into this week's art pieces. So the setting is medieval Europe, after 200 years of the population being absolutely wiped out by the plague. Now, we don't exactly have numbers on this because they didn't keep track of the population the same way we do now, but historians estimate that up to 50% of the population was wiped out by the plague in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries in Europe. Now, in places like Italy and France, it's estimated that up to 80% of the population was wiped out by the plague. So this was something that utterly changed the face of Europe. I think it's hard for us to even think of something that would be like this now. I think the closest thing I could think of would be something like a nuclear attack, because it just totally wiped out the population. So if you think about it, they say that around, their estimate is that 25 million people died. 25 million people is five times the population of Scotland, where I live. And I think also when you think about how much smaller the population of the world was in general back then, the plagues just absolutely demolished Europe in a way that we can't even imagine. An anonymous writer from contemporary at that time wrote, "Realizing what a deadly disaster had come to them, the people quickly drove the Italians from their city. However, the disease remained, and soon death was everywhere. Fathers abandoned their sick sons, lawyers refused to come and make out wills for the dying, friars and nuns were left to care for the sick, and monasteries and convents were soon deserted, as they were stricken too. Bodies were left in empty houses, and there was no one to give them a Christian burial." So, if you get the picture of this, this was an almost apocalyptic world, where people were literally dying in the streets. And like it says here, a lot of what it was left to was the friars and the nuns who were left to take care of the sick, and oftentimes they would become infected too. So, painting this rather apocalyptic world, I'm going to take you to a small monastery in France. This is the Monastery of St. Anthony in Eisenheim, France. Now, St. Anthony was the patron saint of people suffering from skin diseases and the plague. There was a particular skin disease known as St. Anthony's Fire. And so by the time that this painting that we're going to be looking at takes place, the plague had come and gone about every 10, 15 years, depending on where you were, for nearly 200 years. So it was kind of this never-ending scourge that just kind of become a part of the reality of Europe. And when you think about something that wipes out 50% of the population, and this is kind of a, you know, a not natural death in the sense that no death feels natural, but these deaths were ones which were taking place in this kind of violent and crazy manner, you had to become used to death in this sense. You had to kind of face that reality. So in the 200 years that this kind of took place, in about the 13th century or the 14th century, once they started to realize so many people were dying, the church realized that they needed to come up with a way to take care of people who were dying and who were being wiped out by the plague. So in this kind of pastoral move, someone wrote this book called The Ars Moriendi. The reality was that they thought, okay, 50% of our population are going to have to kind of go through this difficult and painful death as the people who are guiding them, as their pastors, their monks, their nuns, the people who are caring for them in their death. We need to find a way to not just care for them in their bodies, not just lead them towards as comfortable of a death as we can, but also for their souls and for their emotional life. So there was this book written that was basically on the art of dying, or the art of dying well, the holy living and holy dying. And it was kind of this literary and spiritual, but also almost artistic work that you were supposed to kind of work through with people who were working towards dying. So there were several versions of this, but the first one, the longest one, was 6 chapters. The first chapter explained to the person that dying was not all bad and that dying was not something to be afraid of. The second chapter kind of set up these 5 temptations they thought that someone would face. So they had, the temptations were a lack of faith, despair, impatience, pride, and avarice. They said these are kind of the things that might come up in your soul as you're preparing to die. And the third chapter lists 7 questions to ask a dying man, along with these corresponding consolations of the love of Christ, this kind of encouragement that he would pass through death and into Christ's love. And then the 4th chapter expresses the need to imitate Christ's life as you are dying. There's kind of this recognition of Christ's submission to death and how as you walk with him, you'll walk towards, eternal life and all that. And then the 5th chapter addresses the family and friends of the person dying. And then the 6th chapter includes prayers for the person who's dying. So when you read it, it's this almost kind of astoundingly practical book that looks into how to die and how to die well. And I think about when it has these 5 temptations, you know, that it kind of lays these out and says, it's okay, it's normal to experience a lack of faith, a feeling of despair. This is how you handle, this is how you approach it. And then even, you know, the 7 questions and the consolations, that there was this kind of sense of, okay, how do we prepare and help people? Because we are living in this world in which death is so completely present to us all the time. And then this was made into these very famous block woodcuts that you can look up if you Google that, and I'll put a couple in the blog as well. So it became this widely spread thing. And as I was researching this, I found this oddly compelling because I think that we live in a world that is, as I was talking about at the beginning, so separated from death that we are kind of, it is the taboo subject. We try not to speak of it. But it's something that we'll all have to face. And because now, of course, I'm so thankful that we do not have to face the plague, but because they had to face the plague, they kind of had to reckon with death and say, okay, this will come to me, whether it's through the plague or through another means, and probably painful means because it's medieval Europe without medical help. How will I face this? How will I face it well? And how can I die well? So this is kind of the preface to this piece. Now, I'm going to take us back to the Eisenheim altarpiece. Now, as I said, this was at a small monastery called the Monastery of St. Anthony in Eisenheim, France. And like I said, St. Anthony was the patron saint of people with skin diseases. And as you know, the plague often was accompanied by the skin disease, but also there was also a separate skin disease called St. Anthony's Fire. And this monastery was specifically a place where people could go when they were suffering from the plague and where the monks were dedicated to taking care of them in their last days. And usually when people went here, they were going there to die. It was to protect their family. And it was either a place where you went as your last hope, where you hoped that maybe you might be healed, you might touch a relic or be prayed for, or even just be cared for physically, or where you went knowing that you were going to die and that you just wanted to be taken care of and not infect your family. So this is the place where this altarpiece was done. So in this place, that was kind of a pilgrimage for the very, very sick and for the dying, and then thinking of this culture in which they wanted to prepare people well, they commissioned an artist. There were several artists, but the one who did the visual painting that we're going to be looking at is Matthias Grunewald, to do something for the chapel. So remember, this is the place where people who are kind of on the edge of death come. And so as they're coming to this chapel, they're oftentimes coming kind of praying what they know will be their last prayers. And so he took this really seriously and thought, what will I paint? Kind of to help them with that. How will I educate them in the Ars Moriendi and the art of dying? And so what he did was this remarkable painting. It is absolutely kind of disturbing and deeply moving. So what we have is that he painted a Christ who is utterly in agony. So it's Christ on the cross. But what you'll immediately notice when you look at it is that it's almost kind of distorted. Christ's body doesn't seem quite right. His hands are stretched out in an excruciating pain. They're kind of like writhing almost. And then his skin has this green tint to it. And it's got pockmarks all over his skin. And then you've got St. Anthony in the corner. And of course, the Virgin Mary. And so this is the painting. You have this picture of Christ that is absolutely, he's rended with pain. His feet are, you can tell, you know, usually you kind of see a Jesus on the cross in these old paintings. Kind of just like he's somehow been super glued onto the cross. And you can't really see, there's nails. And if there are nails, it's kind of like almost like he's been nicely pinned to the cross. But these, the nails are tearing his flesh and his feet look broken. And it's just, it's kind of a deeply upsetting painting. So we need to ask, why was it that Grunewald did this? Why did he create this Christ in pain in this way? And the reason was is that he wanted to create a Christ that identified with the pain of the people who came there. And even down to the skin, when you look at Christ's skin, he painted the skin of Christ in that kind of green discoloration with all the pockmarks in a way that would have looked like those who were coming there with skin diseases and with the plague. And as they looked at this Christ, they were meant to think, I am not alone in my suffering. God has made himself vulnerable to the same sort of pain that I am vulnerable to. And because of that, I am not alone in my death, and my death will not be final. So as they meditated on this painting, that was supposed to be their final message. Some of them, it was the final message they saw, that Christ did not leave them alone in their pain and in their death. And this is something that I've thought about many times when it comes to the problem of evil. There's no way, you know, this is what Tolkien was going on about. There's really no way to reconcile pain in the world and evil in the world. And I don't think that that's a small question. And I think that Grunewald and the people walking through the medieval era when people were dying of plague thought it was a small question. But what they did know, and what I think they're sometimes better at accepting than us, is that they looked to Christ and they said, I don't know why God has allowed pain, but I know that God has also made himself vulnerable to it. He's shown that he is not indifferent to the suffering of humankind. And that in submitting himself to this death, and in submitting himself to this pain, he has also made a way for me to not have this be final. I think also that this painting gave dignity to those who were suffering from these skin diseases. Because, you know, as you can imagine, to come down with a plague was not only to have this incredibly awful and terrible thing happen to your health and to possibly face death, but it was also to face isolation. And what Grunewald did was that he painted a Christ who, it's as it says in scripture, who is a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, that we should despise to look upon him. He had no former majesty. And I think that oftentimes, and this is true in general of the medieval period, that there was this movement towards depicting Christ as humble, as the Christo Patiens, which is the Christ who feels, who understands our suffering. And that was something that dignified them, because it meant that you suffering is not a sign of God's disapproval of you. It's not a sign of you having done something wrong. Rather, we live in a world that's broken, but that God is not indifferent to your brokenness, to your suffering. And so for them, part of learning a good death was meditating upon Christ, who showed them that God was not indifferent to their suffering, that God had experienced, you know, paradoxically and beyond what you can imagine, that God had experienced the pain of death, that this was not God's judgment upon them for having this skin disease, and that there was hope beyond the grave because God had submitted himself to that. And I think that is a really beautiful and heartrending image. And ultimately, the message of this painting, as they meditated upon it, was that you are not alone in your suffering and in your dying. Christ has walked through this, and as you walk through and meditate upon his passion, he will walk through and guide you through your own death. And that in that guidance, there is this hope that the Christ who submitted himself to death and rose again, that you will carry that hope with you, even if you can't see on the other side. And I think that's an incredibly beautiful and comforting idea. And carried with this is the idea that you never die alone, not only because of Christ, but because of all the people who have died in Christ, all the saints that come before you. And so as they walk through this, you know, you think about they're going to St. Anthony's Monastery, who was the saint of people with skin diseases. And so the idea was that as we walk towards this place, we don't walk alone. We walk in the prayers and in the life and in the example of those who've gone before us and have entered into glory. And that brings us to our next example, which is the unstaged opera, The Dream of Gerontius, which was based on the writing of Cardinal John Henry Newman and is a story of a man going and approaching his own death. Now, I'm going to play you a segment that Joel graciously recorded for us where he describes everything about it. And I want to remind you that this is a recording by the Halley Orchestra, which I will give an attachment for my blog, and I encourage you to go buy their music and listen to the entire thing as a Lenten meditation because it is absolutely beautiful. But for now, I'm going to pass you over to Joel, who will examine the dream of Gerontius and the way that it shows that every person that approaches death does not approach it alone, but through the prayers and the example of the faithful and through the grace of Christ.
The Dream of Gerontius is a poem written by John Henry Newman, who was a sort of godfather of the Oxford movement, or the resurgence of Anglo-Catholicism in the Church of England. The poem describes a sort of Christian fantasy of a protagonist, Gerontius, facing his own death. The poem was written in 1865, right in the height of Romanticism, and plays with many of the same themes and developmental devices as Romanticism. However, whereas much of Romantic poetry of the time uses the scaffolding of religion but removes the actual substance of it in favor of a humanistic idealism, The Dream of Gerontius does the opposite, reimagining a traditional religious literary structure, the morality play, through the lens of Romanticism. In this way, Newman neither avoids Romanticism's interest in death, and yet also subverts its idealization of it, instead placing death as the final journey of the faithful man, which ultimately leads him into an encounter with his creator. While the poem is congruent with a sort of morality play journey, rather than battling with a series of embodied vices or being assisted by embodied virtues, Gerontius, in true romantic form, journeys through a landscape of his own emotions leading up to death. Fear, despair, anguish, and uncertainty. He is assisted not by embodied virtues, but by angels and saints, who pray for him with tender loving care and kindness. In this way, the listener of the poem is brought into active and passionate participation in the effective landscape at hand. Edward Elgar composed the setting of the poem as an unstaged opera for orchestra, choir, and solo voices, released in 1900. While composed at the turn of the 20th century, certainly the tail end of Romanticism's reign, the piece is orchestrated in lush, vibrant soundscapes consonant with the finest of High Romanticism's choral and symphonic compositions. This emotive sensibility is articulated from the first moments of the libretto, in which Gerontius describes his own terror at being separated out from his own body, the strange innermost abandonment, the emptying out of each constituent and natural force by which I come to be. The music is tentative, alternating between stuttering pizzicato strings and staccato bassoons, and lush, mysterious diminished harmonies and suspended tremolo. In response, the chorus, sung by what Newman calls assistants of Gerontius, his friends around him at death, call upon all in heaven and earth, from holy innocents to martyrs to choirs of the righteous to pray for him. The arrangement is a tender, caressing a cappella at first, and then is assisted by a hushed bed of strings mirroring the choral harmonies. In this loving prayerfulness, Gerontius is made able to face his trial ahead. In a later passage, Gerontius is cast back into his sphere of disembodiment and begins to be visited by an unseen demonic force, which makes him wild with horror and dismay. Again, the musical environment gives expression to Gerontius's near madness and his fright, with trilling strings and brass horns buffeting the listener back and forth in a torrent of chaos, finally tumbling in a series of brass accents into a collapse of anguished calls for assistance from Christ and Mary.
The harmonia and laughs and flaps its hideous wings and makes me wild with horror and dismay.
When the assistants once again come to offer comfort and support, they pray a litany of various saints who have faced their own trials, and each trial gives voice to an aspect of Gerontius's current trepidation. Noah's homelessness, stranded in open water, Job's distress and all the travesties around him, Moses's despair, longing to be released from the land of bondage, and Goliath's wrath, and David's hope of deliverance from evil. While each begins in plain chant, each line, upon the ending word of Amen, opens up into abundantly rich harmonies of soothing effect, thus perhaps expressing the way that the prayer resonates and finds rooting in the hearts of those called for assistance, far beyond the mere moment of prayer into the heavenlies itself. Finally, at the end of part one, a priest comes forth to bless Gerontius and send him on his way. The blessing is expressed as a sort of affirmation of Gerontius's faithfulness through the trial of his own last journey toward the afterlife, and is set in a vast open landscape of tranquil, untroubled harmonies. Again, it is undergirded by warm strings and subtle brass, and perhaps most importantly here, a heavenly harp. Now, those to whom Gerontius has appealed in his prayerful journey accompany him as he passes through the shadow of death, in a sort of transfiguration of the earlier prayers to all witnesses in heaven and earth. In his faithfulness, Gerontius is given the peacefulness of not being alone in death, both surrounded by his friends and accompanied on his journey by saints and angels. The dream of Gerontius is a triumph of synthesis, interspersing the virtuous power of the medieval journey of the Christ-like everyman with the articulation of Romanticism's emotional idealism, and in so doing, transfigures mere passion into piety.
This leads us neatly into our final example, the Holy Sonnet No. 10 by John Donne, also known as Death Be Not Proud. John Donne was a lawyer, a poet, and a priest, and the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Donne was known as a metaphysical poet. He used strong, sensual imagery, imagery of romance and food and life, to try to describe things of a spiritual reality. Before we go any further, let me read you this poem. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so, for those whom thou thinkest thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure then from thee, much more flow, and soonest our best men with thee do go, rest to their bones and soul delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell, and poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, and better than thy stroke. Why swellest thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. Now this is a funny poem, because in a way, it's almost playful. The first thing you ought to notice is that he's addressing death as a person, and this connects a lot with what Joel was saying, which I'd like to explain a little more, with the idea of a morality play. Now, in the medieval era, at the same time that we're kind of developing these ideas of, you know, the art of death, you also had something in the more artistic realm that was an example of this, and that was the morality play. Now, in the morality play, you had this picture of the everyman who approached his death. Now, death was imagined as a character, so you can see this kind of being worked out in Donne's poetry as he addresses death. And before the everyman meets death, every man has to conquer the vices. So this was usually imagined as you would think of as the seven vices. So you have lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, and pride. And to accomplish the good death, to greet death as a friend, the everyman had to conquer each one of these vices, who were also embodied as these characters, by being aided by the help of these virtues, who were also embodied as these imagined characters. So he would meet lust, and chastity would greet him. And so there was kind of this sense of, okay, to make my way towards death, if I'm able to meet death as a friend, I have to conquer these vices and greet death as a friend because I have conquered them through the help of virtue. So you see this idea of the morality play kind of coming out in Donne as he addresses death as a person. But the further meaning behind this is that Donne not only dresses death, but he says, death, you're really not that powerful. He sort of taunts death, you know, as you look through the way that he articulates it. He says, some have called thee mighty and dreadful, but thou art not so. Or looking down, you see that he says, why swellest thou then? One short sleep passed, and we wake eternally. So there's a sense of he's taunting death. He's saying, you are not that big of a deal. And the reason he can say this is because he has this trust that when you approach the good death in the same way that you had with the, you know, at the very beginning, looking at the good death through Ars Moriendi, that because Christ has also gone through these temptations, faced these vices, and gone to death, through his death we are protected. And so in the end, this is the cinch of the poem. He says, death, thou shalt die. And so as you have this embodied figure that's kind of mimicking the medieval plays, he's saying death is not the final word. Because Christ, the creator of life, has submitted himself to death, death cannot hold him, and therefore he conquers death, meaning that all of us who are united to God, who are protected by that life-giving death, will never see death as the final thing. And so he's able to end with that final saying, you know, of death shall die, which is a kind of a nod to 1 Corinthians 15:26, which says, the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And something that I think is really important in this is that it is saying that death is the enemy. Death is that thing which we find most strange and most inconsistent, that we have a hard time making sense of. I think that there is, even if we, you know, try to be good and hard modernists, there is this kind of incredulity to death, which is, I think, what Tolkien was getting at when he says that we never see any death as natural. It is the mystery that we can't quite see past. But it's through Christ, through looking at the death of Christ, that we are able to kind of approach death and lay down as much fear as we can. So I want to leave with these three kind of ideas that we've looked at today through these art pieces about approaching death. The first is that we are not alone in our death because Christ is with us. And this was really exemplified through the Eisenheim altarpiece that has this picture of the suffering Christ who had the exact same wounds, the exact same vulnerability to death and to sickness that any of us did. It calls to mind those images in the Old Testament of the predictions of the Messiah who would be a man of sorrows acquainted with grief. So we know, first of all, that we are not alone in death because Christ is with us. The second is that we are not alone because the saints, all those who have gone before us in death, are with us. And we looked at that through the Dream of Gerontius, where we see this character that's approaching his death, and as he is afraid, he is encouraged and guided on by the prayers of the godly people around him, the prayers of the saints, and the prayers of Mary for him. So we know that we are not alone in death because all of us will face it, and all of us who are baptized and with Christ in this death know that we can face it with those of us who have gone before us. And then finally, we can draw out this idea that death is not, if we can bear to believe it, final, and that ultimately love has conquered death through Christ, who could not be held down, and so that ultimately this last enemy shall be destroyed. Now, to end today's podcast, I want to read you an excerpt of something that may seem like a hard left turn from all of the beautiful classical pieces that we've been reading, but in some ways it is perhaps the most compelling to me personally. I'm going to end by reading an excerpt from the Harry Potter series. Now, if you have not read Harry Potter, I want to command you and affirm in the strongest terms that you are not allowed to listen to this last segment. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord, remembering that you're not alone in your death because Christ is with you, the saints are with you, and death is not final. But do not listen to this last portion. That is my firm warning, because I'm going to give away all the plot points. If you have read it, let me end with this thought. I think that Harry Potter is a perfect example of a story that deals with reckoning with death. In interviews, J.K. Rowling said that as she wrote it considering what dying meant. She was trying to make sense of this, how we approached it. She wrote it right after her own mother passed away. And so much of the series kind of reckons with this question of what is death? How do we face it? Is there something beyond it? And you can see this distinctly in Harry's story, which has the whole arc of it tending towards his moment when he decides to give up his life, because that's what he has to do to defeat Voldemort. The whole last book is premised around this idea that Harry can either pursue these things that will help him escape death, and we have that with the cloak, the wand, and the resurrection stone, or these things that will ultimately kill Voldemort. And of course, in the end, he has all the ability to escape death. He has the ability to walk away from it. And one by one in the final scene, he lays them down because he realizes that for others to live, he has to approach this death. And I think the more you read into it and look into it, you can really see this picture of the art of dying. There is this picture, I think, that she's trying to draw out of this kind of medieval morality play. And these last sections of the book, Harry reckons with all of these vices and issues and things he overcomes and ultimately comes to the point where he decides to lay down his life. I think also it's fun to note that I think J.K. Rowling was also putting in this kind of nod to both Donne and also to the Bible, because she has these two verses that are particularly placed on the gravestones of his parents. And one of them is, "The last enemy to be destroyed is death." So this passage to me is a powerful depiction of what it looks like to know that as we walk towards death, the thing that is ultimately a mystery that we can't see past, we walk with the faith that we are not alone, that we walk with the good deaths of other people who have loved and prayed and lived faithful lives and conquered vices and embraced virtues before us, and also in the hope that the one thing that will conquer death is love. So this is an excerpt from chapter 34 of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. "I open at the close. Breathing fast and hard, he stared down at it. Now that he wanted time to move as slowly as possible, it seemed to have sped up, and understanding was coming so fast it seemed to have bypassed thought. This was the close. This was the moment. He pressed the golden medal to his lips and whispered, "I am about to die." The metal shell broke open. He lowered his shaking hand, raised Draco's wand beneath the cloak, and murmured, "Lumos." The black stone with its jagged crack running down the center sat in the two halves of the snitch. The resurrection stone had cracked down the vertical line, representing the Elder Wand, the triangle representing the cloak, and the stone were still discernible. And again, Harry understood without having to think. It did not matter about bringing them back, for he was about to join them. He was not really fetching them. They were fetching him. He closed his eyes and turned the stone over his hand 3 times. He knew it had happened because he heard a slight movement around him that suggested frail bodies shifting their footing on the earthy, twig-strewn ground that marked the outer edge of the forest. He opened his eyes and looked around. They were neither ghosts nor true flesh. He could see that. They resembled most closely the riddle that had escaped from the diary so long ago, and he had been memory made nearly solid. Less substantial than living bodies, but more than ghosts, they moved towards him, and on each face there was a loving smile. James was exactly the same height as Harry. He was wearing the clothes in which he had died, and his hair was untidy and ruffled, and his glasses were a little lopsided, like Mr. Weasley's. Sirius was tall and handsome, and younger by far than Harry had seen him in life. He loped with an easy grace, his hands in his pockets and a grin on his face. Lupin was younger, too, and much less shabby, and his hair was thicker and darker. He looked happy to be back in this familiar place, the scene of so many adolescent wanderings. Lily's smile was the widest of all. She pushed her long hair back as she drew close to him, and her green eyes, so like his, searched his face hungrily, as though she would never be able to look at him enough. "You've been so brave." He could not speak. His eyes feasted on her, and he thought that he would like to stand and look at her forever, and that would be enough. "You are nearly there," said James. "Very close. We are so proud of you." "Does it hurt?" The childish question fallen from Harry's lips before he could stop it. "Dying? Not at all," said Sirius. "Quicker and easier than falling asleep." "And he will want it to be quick. He wants it over," said Lupin. "I didn't want you to die," Harry said. These words came without his volition. "Any of you, I'm sorry." He addressed Lupin more than any of them, beseeching him. "Right after you had your son, Remus, I'm sorry." "I'm sorry, too," said Lupin. "Sorry I will never know him. But he will know why I died, and I hope he will understand. I was trying to make a world in which he could live a happier life." A chilly breeze that seemed to emanate from the heart of the forest lifted the hair at Harry's brow. He knew that they would not tell him to go, that it would have to be his decision. "You'll stay with me." "Until the very end," said James. "They won't be able to see you," asked Harry. "We are a part of you," said Sirius, "invisible to anyone else." Harry looked at his mother. "Stay close with me," he said quietly, and he set off.